Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick O'Shaughnessy at History Chappie on social media. Today, we are absolutely delighted to be joined by East London Residente, Catherine Green. Catherine, welcome to Versus History. How are you today?
Doing really well, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure. Now, I'm not going to spoil the show. I'm going to let you tell us all about what you're talking about, obviously, because you're the expert. But it's about crate digging, the Underground Records and Newham Heritage Month. They're all in there in some way, shape or form. So if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about you, your background and what you're doing with those three historically related initiatives. So over to you, Catherine.
So I grew up in East London, so a place called Walthamstow, which is in a borough called Waltham Forest. So East London is historically like a poorer part of London. It's a place with high diversity. It's a place where traditionally a lot of immigration has happened over the years. And it's a place where community is really important traditionally and still now. So growing up, I was very aware of being part of a community, being part of sort of having family living close by. And I've always been interested in that kind of sense of belonging. Like, what does it mean to be part of a community? What does it give people? As I was growing up, I got very interested in art and particularly photography. So for the past, I would say sort of 10 to 15 years, I've been a practicing photographer. And I tend to photograph places and people which aren't traditionally represented in the media. So these would be kind of working class histories, perhaps, maybe histories of people that volunteer or that don't usually get the kind of kudos and recognition, maybe in, you know, like the broadsheets or sort of newspaper spreads. So always looking for those untold stories and the sort of unsung heroes. So I also, as well as doing my own photography work, which is called social documentary photography, I also collaborate with four other artists and writers, and I've done so over the past 5 years. So we work together under the name Rendezvous Projects. And Rendezvous Projects, all of us are interested in different ways in social history. We're artists and writers, and we tend to collaborate on projects that look at different ways of capturing and recording social history and then creative ways of representing them to the public. So they might be in books or in exhibitions. It might be involving young people or having sort of older groups like reminiscence projects. So perhaps to illustrate that, I might tell you about a couple of the projects we've done to date before I tell you about the current project.
Yeah, please do. Go for it.
So we've done a project about Warner Housing Estate. So a Warner Housing Estate was in East London, and it was a very well-built sort of Victorian and Edwardian housing estate. And there was many people that rented there over the years. We interviewed people that were like sixth generation of tenants. So we captured about 30, 40 oral histories and really trying to kind of capture those stories of community and how important it is to sort of live together, tell those stories. We collected photographs, which actually ended up coming from all over the world. We had photographs coming from Australia, from America, of people that lived in the Warner Estate and really held it dear to their heart. And for that, we put together a website, which is a sort of resource of memories and even sort of restoration tips for people that own Warner houses now, or Warner flats now. And we put together a book. And we've also done a project about the pre-digital printing history of East London. So that would be places like Hackney, Tower Hamlets, Bethnal Green, Waltham Forest. So looking at capturing those sort of printers' stories and some of the community presses and the radical presses that were maybe printing sort of political information in the 70s, 80s, 90s. So looking at how they transformed up until the digital era kind of stopped what they were doing. The last project we did was about the history of pirate radio in East London, in specifically Morven Forest, and the history of rave, and how really sort of working class people came together from all different cultural backgrounds to create a music scene that then went on to influence UK music and then world music. So that project, Crate, was called Sweet Harmony Radio Rave in Morven Forest, kind of led on to the Crate Dinkum project, which is in Newham, which I've been working on recently.
You wove a great story there. Yeah, that's really how I got in contact with you, Catherine, through the pirate radio thing, because I am a regular listener. I've been listening for about 8 years now to Uncle Doug's show, which is a show on Rinse FM, sort of predicated on jungle drum and bass music. But I've been listening to pirate radio, Rinse FM, since like the late 1990s. I'm from Lewisham. So I was listening a couple of weeks ago and you were on there and you were talking about crate digging and you were a guest alongside Uncle 22. So I think that brings us nicely to sort of explain how we got this conversation together, but what crate digging and the Underground Records is all about. So would you like to take it from there? So crate digging, the Underground Records, Newham Heritage Month, where do they all fit together and how are you going about sort of showcasing those and their historical significance?
So first of all, a little bit about how the project came about. So I was working in London Borough of Morven Forest on the Sweet Harmony project, which was the one specifically about radio and rave. And a couple of people said to me, you must go and speak to, so-and-so from the Underground Records. The Underground Records was in the neighbouring borough of Newham. So I only had funding for one specific area. And so I had this little project idea in my head for a long time, thinking about this record shop. The Underground Records. And then Newham Heritage Month happens every May in the London Borough of Newham. And they had like an open call for grant funding. So I applied. The theme of the funding this year was shops, factories and the docks. So it seemed perfect. So I applied for funding and I was successful. And just to tell you a little bit about the Borough of Newham, I think I'm right in saying that Newham has the highest diversity in the whole country. So Newham historically has been a very diverse borough because they had the docks there. So it was a place where people from all over the world would come in and out. It was a very sort of vibrant, buzzy, bustling and important borough. But of course that's changed a lot and it's a very sort of poor borough now. But a borough that has this kind of rich cultural heritage and has particularly rich heritage in music. So anyway, the Underground Records was a record shop in a small area in that borough called Forest Gate. It was a record shop that was set up by somebody called Mike the Underground, his brother Peter, who's also known as Cool Hand Flex, a producer called Uncle 22 and a DJ called DJ Randall. They actually met on pirate radio station. And when that pirate radio station went down and was closed down, they sort of wanted to carry on working together and collaborating together in a creative way. And so they got together and found a studio in this shop. It kind of came together quite organically. They definitely, none of them felt they were from a business background. And so this record shop was only around for about 5 or 6 years, but it was a place that ended up being a bit of a community centre. It brought a lot of people together and then went on to have an impact on lots of people's lives and on the music industry and the changes that were happening in the early 90s in the music industry in Britain. So it was open around 91 and it closed around 96. So crate digging, the project for Newham Heritage Month, was really about trying to capture that heritage and that history. So I interviewed 18 people that were closely associated with the shop, did oral history interviews with each of them, and managed to capture the main protagonists, all but one. And with that, took that oral history. It's been transcribed, so it will go into Newham archives. So it will be there for future generations to explore and discover. And I've also gone on to use it with several creative outputs. So there was a walk around the area where you had QR codes on the lamppost so that people could take a picture on their phone that would access a SoundCloud file, and they'd be able to listen to edited snippets of those oral histories that tell the story from particular parts of the shop. So that was a 6-part audio trail. So there was kind of themes like how the shop started, the atmosphere in the shop, the atmosphere in the studio, the kind of success they had, and what they went on to do.
So as people are walking around, they can actually participate in the history, like live it and breathe it via the QR code as like a mechanism to access all that. Is that right?
Exactly. And what I was really struck by when I was talking to people about the history of the underground was there's a sort of corner of shops, a row of shops, and there were people just hanging outside. You know, there was music playing, there was takeaway shops there was barbers. It was a real kind of buzzy, lively atmosphere with all this kind of creativity, all of, you know, people turning up from all over the country, let alone all over London, to sort of feel the vibe, buy records. And when you go there now, it's quite a quiet place. The record shop is no longer a record shop, it's flats. So by putting these QR codes in where people could access snippets of music, snippets of the interview, I wanted to kind of generate some sense of what actually was the creativity that came from that spot, and some of the atmosphere, some of the liveliness that obviously you don't get there now.
Of course, yeah, what a creative, innovative way to showcase and platform underrepresented histories. Thank you for sharing that with us, Catherine. Okay, the next question I think leads quite logically from the previous one. Obviously, the D-Underground staff records, D-Underground record staff, it reads like a sort of list of royalty of early jungle pioneers. But I'm guessing there'll be people out there that are scratching their heads and thinking, how could like a record shop, a single shop in a single location, become such a cauldron of creativity and so important and pivotal to the early 90s, like rave, jungle, drum and bass scene? Why, basically, I suppose, why was this shop so important in its day?
I think it was in the right place at the right time. I think that's part of it. I think, you know, in lots of other hubs and central places across the UK at the time, there was a lot of creativity going on. There was the kind of evolution of the equipment and the software that people were using to produce music. So that was an element of a kind of catalyst, people being able to afford to get their hands on equipment. But particularly, I think the history that we're talking about is really the history of West Indian families that had come to, maybe sort of second generation, that had come to East London, and with them had brought the influence of sound system culture. There was definitely in Forest Gate a massive sound system, sort of Jamaican sound system culture, and that kind of musical influence was in a lot of the people's family backgrounds. So as well as that, there was a kind of the need to find sort of safe spaces, I guess. Like, a lot of Black people wouldn't have been welcome into local pubs and clubs, and so often ended up making their own entertainment at home and having sound systems and parties in their own homes. So I think there's sort of elements of that that brought a community together. There was a musical tradition, a musical cultural heritage that was a very sort of rich seedbed, I guess, for then the sort of influence of American hip hop coming in, the availability of sampling machines, drum machines, the availability of spaces in East London, because East London was a place that had a lot of vacant or underutilized buildings. So I guess that all played into it. I mean, I have to say, whilst I was around at the time, I didn't go to the underground. I wasn't living in that area at the time. So what I'm saying is what I'm taking from what other people have told me. So I don't want to be speaking for other people, but this is what I've taken from the interviews that I've done. So a real mix. And then the type of people, the people that were there were, I think, very open to collaboration, and just bounced off ideas off each other. So they came together with this real spirit of openness and collaboration and absolute love and passion for music that were just driven, you know, they were driving each other on to make more and more creative pieces of work, just bouncing off each other. And I think then that kind of passion just drew other people naturally in there. So just a really exciting time, and it was a time when music was evolving massively, and sort of rather than just having American music coming into the country, it was a time when young UK producers started taking all those influences and making a UK sound, a truly UK sound, a truly original sound. And that kind of early 90s progression through sort of hardcore into jungle music and then into drum and bass was really prolific. So they were, yeah, a mixture of being in the right place, right time, real creative talents, passion, knowledgeable about music, and that kind of diversity of Forest Gate and Newham all played a part.
Thank you very much for that, Catherine. Yeah, I never went to the Underground Records either. I was a little bit too young, but I did go to Black Market Records in Soho and Big Apple in Croydon a lot to pick up tape packs. And you're exactly right. They were like entrepôts. They were like hubs for the musical community. And furthermore, you're right about East London. I mean, the amount of pirate radio stations that came out of East London, Cool FM, Rinks FM, and the list goes on and on and on. It really, really was the sort of hub and the pivot of that creative milieu at the time. And I think you explained that exceptionally well to someone that might not be too au fait with that particular background. So thank you for that, Catherine. I suppose the next question then is, why did the shop close in the end, and what was lost when it finally did? I'm sure it's not monocausal. I'm sure there's a number of different factors that probably play into it. And for anyone that's interested at looking at some of the chief protagonists, there's an audio history on the website where people can look through what people have said who were actually there at the time, so a primary source document. But what do you think, Catherine? What led to the demise of the shop? Was it the rise of digital music, the emergence of UK garage, gentrification, all of the above, none of the above? What do you think?
I definitely don't think it was gentrification. I think it was a mixture of things from what I can tell. I mean, I think there was definitely kind of challenges within the group of people that were working there. You know, like some of them were getting really successful and really busy. There was demands on people's time. There was sort of money coming in. And you know, probably I assume sort of challenges with distributing that, and you know, all of those kind of things when a business becomes successful and you maybe not started out with a business plan or an exit plan, and you know, things just suddenly and absolutely explode. You know, suddenly you're sort of getting more orders than you can fulfill, and it's just kind of, I imagine, probably quite exciting, but also a bit overwhelming. But then also the music scene was starting to change by about 96. So UK Garage was...
That was massive. That was massive, yeah. And then some.
And then I think also there was some negativity in the press about jungle music, and I can't help thinking that probably had an impact. And yeah, people were starting to buy in slightly different ways. CD market was opening up. So yeah, a mixture, a real mixture. I think it's the music has definitely stood the test of time, and the music that came out of there, you think it still sounds so fresh 25, 30 years later.
No, without a doubt. And I think it would be remiss of us not to mention all the other record shops have gone by the wayside too. Every single one that I can think of or ever went to buy a tape pack, they're all gone. So it's not just the Underground Records. This is a wider and shift.
You asked what was lost. Yeah. And I think that's a really important question, because I think really what was lost was a community hub, like a creative community hub. A lot of the people I spoke to described the Underground as a community centre. So a lot of people didn't just go to buy records, but would simply go to hang out, speak to people, meet other people. And that was really across the board, like lots of different ages mixing together in one place, different cultural backgrounds mixing in one place. So I think that kind of community centre aspect was really, really, really important. And that was lost. And I can't think of anything else that has replaced that in our kind of, for the young people now, young people then. I can't think of another institution or venue that kind of had that mix of people, ages, cultural backgrounds.
No, I'm thinking about other musics that have originated from East London or Bow or E3, like grime. Whilst they've been exponentially successful, they've not been rooted in a record shop or sort of dub plate cutting culture either. So it's sort of evolved, for want of a better word. Thank you very, very much indeed for that. Okay, the next question then. What is the legacy and significance of the Underground Records? Is it the rise of jungle and the names associated with the shop, as MC Navigators indicates in the audio transcript? Or can it be traced and linked to grime's lineage and development too? What do you think?
Oh, it's a massive question, that.
It's very convoluted, but I'm sure you'll make some sense of it.
So what is the legacy and significance? I think that it had a kind of collective significance in how it contributed to the drive and change in the music of the time, and sort of driving on that creative development and that lineage from sort of reggae through hardcore to jungle and drum and bass. I think it had a huge impact and legacy and significance for individual people on their careers. So it influenced a lot of people's career choices, gave them opportunities that they may not otherwise have had, gave them ideas about what could potentially, what music could offer them in terms of careers. I definitely think, I mean, I think you put two quotes out, one from Navigator, which says, "The underground, let it be known from Navi, is one of the original platforms that made this music what it is and gave people like myself, Randall, Uncle 22, Cool Hand Flex, a springboard into the business to get noticed and for people to hear of our music. That's what the underground meant to me." So yes, definitely it was one of the founding platforms of jungle music in the UK and drum and bass music in the UK, which is now a global, massive global export.
It sure is, yeah.
And I do think it, the influence of that can be traced to grime. So grime very much is associated with Forest Gate, which is the area that the record shop was in. And I mean, the musical heritage in that, it's a very small area, Forest Gate. It's a small area within the Borough of Newham. It's the musical heritage that's come out of that area is enormous. I think it can be traced back to the sound system culture. And there's people like Footsie from Newham Generals, who is a grime artist, who I think it's his uncle or his father was in King Original Sound, one of the original sound systems in the area. And a lot of people mentioned that he was influenced by the presence of the Underground Records, even though he was a very young boy at the time, as well as obviously the sound system. So I think people just walking past and hearing the records being played, hearing the shop being played, knowing that there was people from around the country and around London coming to Forest Gate just to hear what people were doing in this shop, kind of gave people the confidence to explore music, I think, and just kind of explore that rich musical heritage in the area.
How has Crate Digging, Catherine, set about the task of celebrating, sharing and preserving the cultural history of this Forest Gate institution? And how can people get involved if they want to do so?
So we've set about the task of celebrating, sharing and preserving in a number of ways. So first of all, through oral history. So through doing oral history interviews, trying to capture those historical details and the memories of people that were there at the time, transcribing those and putting them into Newham archives so that people in the future can access them. We've also collected some photographs from a very celebrated photographer called Eddie Ochia. And he has very kindly given the photographs to the archive. So again, there's photographic record that people will be able to access in the future. So I think that's the way we've sort of captured and preserved. And then we've shared this history in a number of ways. The walk that's the sort of physical walk that you have to do in Forest Gate. But also we've put together a podcast, which is just under an hour. and mixes together all of the voices that we spoke to as part of this story, telling the story from different perspectives, from their own perspectives, and in a kind of themed, structured podcast. So that can be accessed via the Newham Heritage Month website, which is newhamheritage.org. Or it's also on our Rendezvous Projects website, which you can Google. And then we've also put together a short video. It's only a 7-minute video on the Newham Heritage site. There is a mix by a DJ called Warlock, which is a 1-hour, 45-minute mix of some rare tracks from the Dianne stable, which is really brilliant, and that can be accessed also on the Newham Heritage website. And finally, we put together a booklet. So it's a limited edition booklet with a fold out poster from Eddie Ochier, and the booklet contains some historical information as well as some quotes from the oral history, and that will be available from our Rendezvous Projects website in the next couple of weeks. And I think that's main ways we've done it. We've also been trying to capture any other memories via a form on our website, so people are welcome to put in their own memories if we weren't able to include them as part of the project. So how can people get involved? They can listen to the podcast, they can share the podcast. You can also, if you have your own memories of the Underground Records, you could share those via our project page on the Rendezvous Projects website. So I think it's just about sort of sharing and, yeah, passing around if it's of interest.
Well, I'm sure it will be. Thank you very much indeed, Catherine. All right, the final question there. Whenever we get guests on, which is pretty regularly, our listeners always ask, you know, how they can emulate or how can they, what they can borrow from the expertise or practices of our guests. So the question for you then is, what advice would you give to someone that wants to showcase an aspect of local history in their area in the way that you have? What advice would you give? What steps could one possibly take in their own context? Or in other words, what do you wish you'd known 10 years ago that you now know that you'd like to share with our listeners?
So I think there's several different ways I can answer that question. First of all, I would say there is no history that is too niche to cover. I remember when I was planning the Pirate Radio project, which is about a very small area in East London, and thinking that people wouldn't necessarily be interested outside the area, but then getting orders for the book that I made for that from like Japan, Europe, America. So if you're interested in it, somebody else will be interested in it. I think that's been a real lesson. And then I guess in terms of sort of practical advice I could give, there's probably, well, we tend to do a lot of oral history, and there's very specific ways to do oral history properly and to do it in a way that means it's archive quality. So I would research how you do oral history. There's probably a local oral history society that has those answers already. Seek them out. Because if you start in the right way, then you'll be able to leave that record for the future. If you don't start in the right way, and if you don't get the right permissions, there might be problems with people being able to access and use that information in the future. So research things like the sort of permission forms that you need to use, research the local oral history societies, look at your local archives, what kind of form do they take submissions in. I think it's really important to think long term. People will be interested in the future, and it does need to be of high quality. And then you can get lots of free equipment or sort of cheap equipment. For recording, I tend to use a Zoom recorder. For oral history editing, I use a free software called Audacity, which is pretty straightforward to use. And then I guess it's just like talking to people. If you're interested in history, you've got to like talking to people. And so, yeah, just talk to whoever you can, and it's always surprising sort of what comes out. We in the UK tend to have funding bodies that fund projects. For Rendezvous Projects, we changed our setup to a CIC, a community interest company, which meant that we were then eligible to apply for particular funds, like a fund called the National Lottery Heritage Fund. That will differ all over the world, so I guess you need to find out what funding you'd be eligible for as either an individual or as an organisation. You could talk to local museums and galleries and get involved with what they might be doing. They might have projects on already. They might have interest in the sort of project ideas that you've got. So yeah, just don't assume that it's niche. Even if it is, just there'll be somebody out there that's got an interest. So don't hesitate. You know, if you're exploring particularly history of older people, you might lose the opportunity to record that history unless you act on it. So yeah, just get on and do it and enjoy it. Have fun.
That is absolutely sterling advice. You have never thought about it in that way, Catherine. Not only are you sort of archiving or making the past available in the now, but you're essentially, it's a projectile to the future, right? You're planting trees whose shade you may never see. So that's fantastic advice. You're doing something in the now about the past for the future. So that's great. Thank you very, very much, Catherine. Now, is there anything that my limited and short-sighted questions didn't give you the opportunity to talk about that you would like to have mentioned, or is there anything that you want to just reiterate for our listeners before we let you go about your merry way?
I think actually you highlighted the importance of pirate radio in the catalyst, creative catalyst in East London, of how music was spread, disseminated, shared, and I didn't mention that earlier, so that is absolutely key to, I think, why East London has this history of kind of creativity, and particularly in music. I guess I just want to reiterate that I am speaking from the interviews that I've done, and I wouldn't want to be like a spokesperson for these lovely people that
of course.
So yeah, just a kind of, I guess, a massive nod and of appreciation to everybody that's taken part in the project, and I hope I've done them justice, really.
Oh, you certainly have. You've done them justice. You've done scene justice. You've done this very deserving history justice, and you showcased it. Just on the pirate radio thing, obviously, I was brought up in South East London, and I didn't have Sky TV. So Super Sunday to me, which is all about Cool FM Super Sunday on pirate radio, whereas for most people around the country, Super Sunday would have meant Sky Sports screening of the soccer, but I didn't have Sky. So when I hear Super Sunday, I don't think Sky Sports. I think East London, Cool FM, and all the DJs and MCs that came through that platform. So, yeah, you cannot underestimate the importance of pirate and community radio, not just in East London and London, but worldwide. So thank you very, very much, Catherine. Really appreciate you giving us your time. Now, just final question for me. If people want to get in touch with you or follow you on social media, is there any way they can do that or follow the project?
Yeah, actually, if you go to rendezvousprojects.org.uk, and that's got all of our social media presence on there. So that's the place to start.
Thank you very much indeed, Catherine. I'm going to let you go and be happy and keep serving up and showcasing superb history. So on behalf of myself, the co-editors, all the listeners, we're so grateful that you've come on Versus History to share your expertise, wisdom and insight. Thank you, Catherine. We're very, very grateful.
Thank you.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.